This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hello, hello, hello. Hi there. I can't see you, but you can see me. This seems appropriate. My name is Avi Lewis. Welcome once again to the luscious Lenzik Performing Arts Center, home lo these many years to an immovable feast of literary delights, in which you get to luxuriate, you lucky sods, simply because the Lannan Foundation loves you and is committed to your unending intellectual sustenance. And you should applaud. This is not the first time I've had the opportunity to share this stage with a great writer in the In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom series. And I have to say, for an interviewer, this is actually like the greatest gig on earth. A sumptuous, soft cedar, an audience that is well-read, well-dressed, open-minded, most of whom have spent the hours before showtime in enthusiastic exploration of the bar. You, sir. I have deeply enjoyed my previous evenings here, basking in the radical charm of Arundhati Roy, jousting with Chuck Bodin and his irascible, armor-piercing wit, soaking up the anecdotes of the great raconteur Tariq Ali. I've had a good run. Of course, I am a mere interloper here to compare to the great and greatly beloved Amy Goodman, who by my count has held court here no fewer than a dozen times, and David Barsamian, of course, America's foremost compulsive interviewer. Seriously, you get in an elevator with that guy and you have divulged your deepest secrets before the next floor. David has me well in the rearview mirror with at least 8 Lenzik notches on his microphone. And don't even get me started on that guy, Michael Silverblatt, who has been blessed to stand here before you more than 20 times. My naked envy, as unseemly as it is, I think, entirely justified. No matter when you come to a Lannan event in Santa Fe, you are sure to be graced with a conversation that will tickle your brain, enliven your outrage, and dump you onto the street afterwards with mind, heart, and conversation racing. Now, I don't just say this to reinforce your Santa Fean solipsism. Despite appearances, you are not the center of the intellectual world. But thanks to the Lannan Foundation, you are pretty damn close. And tonight, if we do our jobs right, we'll bring you a little bit closer. With all of the luminaries who come through here twinkling in the background, I hope no one will be offended when I confess that I'm most excited about our guest tonight. I have the honor of warming up this magnificent piece of lucite for Greg Grandin, who is here for the very first time. And I think we ought to show him a quick pre-welcome, because by day, a mild-mannered professor of history at NYU, by night, a mild-mannered author of life-changing works of nonfiction, Greg is possessed of a talent that is anything but mild. As many of you know from his frequent appearances on Democracy Now!, Greg is known for his expertise on the history of Latin America, particularly on the role of the United States in the life of our neighbors to the south. For those of you who are new to Greg's work, let me share my own sort of whirlwind highlights reel of his recent books. And for the many Grandinites in the audience, you know who you are, this will be just a mere brush-up. Empire's Workshop, though not his first major work by any means, was a breakthrough book. Published in 2007 in the twilight of the Bush era, it was nothing short of revelatory. For many of us who at that time were fervently following the pink tide of leftish governments in Latin America, the experience was like reading by the light of a candle when someone walks into the room and flicks on the floodlights. Greg demonstrated that the United States has not just treated Latin America as a big backyard over the last 200 years, but rather that Latin America has served as a laboratory, test kitchen, and proving ground for the entire apparatus of American empire. From refining counterinsurgency military tactics, to testing Milton Friedman economics, to waging war in the name of spreading democracy, to cementing domestic coalitions here in the United States of evangelicals and neocons, or neoliberals, as we call them now, through the development of soft power, the resurgence of hard power, the rise of the doctrine of preemptive warfare, Latin America was where the United States literally became an empire in every sense of the word. And Greg helped us understand that in an exhaustive way. He showed how a study of Reagan's dirty wars was an indispensable primer for understanding the Bush-Cheney global war. And in the process, he gave us the tools to understand what was going on at that pivotal moment, both in Latin America and in the U.S. empire writ large, which is to say, he gave us the tools to take apart the official story and to strip away some of its power. Greg followed Empire's workshop with a Pulitzer Prize finalist, a book called Fordlandia. It is a brilliant work of historical research and a stunning piece of storytelling. It's the entirely surreal tale of Henry Ford's hubristic adventure as he tried and spectacularly failed to build a corporate utopia in the rainforest of the Brazilian Amazon. On the surface, it was a rubber plantation. But as Greg skillfully reveals, Ford conceived of it as nothing less than a privatized model society, embedded in every detail with the paternalistic, Puritan, and worker-exploiting vision that is rightly associated with that great name of American capitalism. And as the tale of a grand disaster, it also documents the many failures of the ideology that spawned it. In his latest work, The Empire of Necessity, Greg takes a deep look at a single remarkable story, a slave revolt at the turn of the 19th century that ended in a life-and-death theatrical shipboard performance. No spoilers from me. I will leave it to Greg to tell you more. But what's striking about the book is how he relentlessly tracks down every revealing detail about the many characters in this sprawling drama, and in the process weaves a gripping story that leads the reader with great subtlety to a deeper understanding of our entire modern world. It's no surprise that Greg is both a beloved and best-selling author, despite being a hugely admired academic. His powers of historical sleuthing are legendary, and his writing is entirely unafflicted by the jargon and self-impressed density of much academic prose. Bottom line is, he is a master of narrative. And this is what takes his skill as an historian and elevates him to the kind of writer who can change your life. And it's that quality that I have come to love and value so deeply about Greg's work. Over the last 4 years, I've been working on a book and film project about the economic roots of the climate crisis. And what has become really clear to me in this long research project, in looking at the unsustainable, hell, the suicidal system that we live in, is that we are made of stories, driven by stories. We are living and dying our stories. Our stories make us. And if we don't change them, they will break us. All our systems, from our economy and our culture to the way we make energy and deal with waste, are based on narratives that are baked into us from earliest childhood. Stories that celebrate domination of nature, of other people, of other peoples. Stories of endless frontiers, boundless benevolent technologies that save the day at the last minute, resources consumed with abandon and no limits. If we want to change course before our system drives us all off the cliff, we must change our stories. We need to transform the cultural narratives that underpin every aspect of our disastrously failing system. And that's why Greg, for my money, is one of the most important voices of our time, particularly for citizens of the Americas. By telling the true tales of our past, by tracing the narratives that have formed it, by digging deep into the foundations of the present, he holds out to us a trailing bundle of stories. It's our job to grab hold and yank them up by the roots. Ladies and gentlemen, Greg Grandin.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Avi, for that really lovely, lovely introduction. It's really an honor to be here on the stage with somebody whose work I respect so much. I show the take in every class that I teach, no matter what it's about. I make my students watch the take. And it's wonderful to be here at the Lannan Foundation and in this wonderful theater and be part of this great project of political literacy. And I just want to thank you for inviting me. So in 1855, Herman Melville wrote an otherworldly novella. It was nominally set on a Spanish slave ship in the remote South Pacific, but it really took place in the mind of the master class. Not the slave-owning master class of antebellum America. In Melville's rendition of Amasa Delano, around whom events in the story circulate, Delano is a modernizer. He's a modern man. He's a new man of the American Revolution. He embodies a cheery optimism about the world. He sees himself as opposed to slavery in both practice and in law and in sensibility. He believes himself an egalitarian. The story was called is called Benito Sereno, and it was published at a very consequential moment in Melville and the nation's life. As I mentioned, it was 1855. It was a few years after the publication and appearance of Moby Dick, and a few years before the oncoming Civil War, the launch of the Civil War. It was just as a moment that Herman Melville himself broke down physically and emotionally. We think of Moby Dick now as the American novel. But at the time, it was roundly panned. Critics, it didn't sell. Critics thought it was, at best, an indication of Melville's irrelevance, or at worst, an indication of his madness and his lunacy. And then, of course, Benito Sereno was coming right before the Civil War, a moment of deep despair, when people of Melville's generation thought that there was no exit from the crisis that the trafficking in human bodies in the South and slavery, chattel slavery, had brought upon the nation, that there would only be really two options. One is to confront slavery head on, and that would lead to the destruction of the nation. This experiment in liberty that was the American Republic, or let slavery be and accept the fact that freedom for some, liberties for some, meant enslavement of others, a very limited notion of freedom. And in a way, Benito Sereno captures that dilemma and that despair like no other piece of work in American literature. As I mentioned, it takes place in the South Pacific. And a good contrast is with Moby Dick, and in terms of form and style. Moby Dick is the sprawling, generous, capacious novel that takes place over a number of different oceans and brings together peoples of all races in a novel that has a catastrophic ending but is joyous in a lot of its prose. Benito Sereno is the exact opposite in form. It's compressed and condensed into one day on one ship and then into one mind, into Amasa Delano's mind. Nothing much happens in the story. It all takes place largely through Amasa Delano's point of view. Melville tells the story from Amasa Delano's perspective. He boards this slave ship that he comes across. He's in the South Pacific sealing on his ship, and he comes across this distressed vessel that has tattered sails. Its hull is calcified. It's trailing a long garland of seagrass. It looks very haunting and spooky. It's a strange ship. And Delano boards it, and he spends all day on board the ship. And events conspire that he's left alone. He sends his own men to a remote island, a nearby island, to fill up the water casks and to fetch back some food. And he spends all day by himself watching the workings of what he thinks is a normally functioning, a distressed but normally functioning slave ship. There's dozens of West African men and women and a few children. There's a handful of Spaniards. And then there's the man who introduces himself as captain, Benito Sereno, who is tended to and waited on by a man named Babo. Is introduced as his black body servant, his slave. And Delano becomes increasingly obsessed with the relationship between the two men. Sereno grows increasingly vacant and unresponsive. Delano watches as Babo tends to him, wipes spittle from his mouth, holds him up, shaves him. And he knows something's wrong, but he can't quite figure out what it is. And it's revealed about two-thirds into the story, towards the end, when it's revealed to Delano, the character, that things aren't as they seem, that the slaves aren't slaves or the West Africans aren't slaves, that they're actually running things, that they're choreographing this whole scene, this whole spectacular, that they had risen up months earlier, seized the ship, killed most of the Spaniards, including the slaver who was taking them to Lima to be sold and demanded to be returned to Senegal. Melville tells the story in a series of flashbacks, and it's revealed that Benito Sereno, the Spanish captain, stalled. He sailed first up and down the coast of Chile, trying to avoid having to round Cape Horn, and which would have been very dangerous. And Delano doesn't realize any of this. He can't see that it's choreographed. So I assigned this book. I assigned this book to my classes. And about 6 or 7 years ago, I was preparing to teach it. And I was teaching it as a kind of illustration of Anglo attitudes toward Spaniards and Spaniards' attitudes toward Anglo, and how it was mediated through this institution of slavery, how we can think about slavery as an institution that was Pan-American in scope and it wasn't just based in the United States as we often think of slavery. And I was reading a footnote of a secondary book, a literary theorist that I was preparing for the class, and the footnote mentioned that the story was all true, that it was that Melville got the story from the memoirs of a real historical person, a sea captain named Amasa Delano. And I remember staring at that footnote for quite a while. I was literally dumbstruck. I mean, it was kind of like being told that that Ridley Scott's Alien was true. In a lot of ways, the structures of the story are the same, that you know there's evil on board, you know it's lurking somewhere, you don't know what, until this big explosive ending in which the reality is revealed. And also, even beyond that, even beyond the structure, it was uncanny. How could this group of West Africans have pulled off this deception in the middle of the South Pacific? And how could they have tricked an experienced mariner? It turns out Amasa Delano, the real historic Amasa Delano, was a distant descendant of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, from a not particularly successful branch of the Delano family and from Massachusetts. And he was an experienced sailor. He had circumnavigated. He was in the middle of his third circumnavigation of the globe. He liked to think of himself as a man of the world who could see the world as it was, and a practical man. And yet he fell prey to this elaborately staged con, a nine-hour full cast pantomime of the master slave relation. It was quite a remarkable story. And so I started doing some more research on it. I read Delano's memoir. So when I say that Melville based the story on Delano's memoir and it's a true story, it's not true the way Moby Dick is true. Moby Dick is true in the sense that it's drawn a little bit from the actual stoving of the whale ship Essex by an enraged whale. But Melville drew as much from King Lear, from Shakespeare's King Lear, from Milton's Paradise Lost, from all of these great epics in world literature of rebellion and arrogance and hubris. Benito Cereno, it turns out, is remarkably faithful to Chapter 18 of Amasa Delano's memoir. It's just almost a literal, almost transcriptural in its chronological terms. Melville fills in the atmosphere, and his addition, the value added, is how he's able to enter the mind of a New England Yankee who understands himself as modern and understands himself as a reformer, and tap into and reveal this kind of new kind of racism, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But the events are remarkably similar, to the point where when Melville actually reproduces all of these legal documents that Delano has in his memoir. It was very opaque in his motives. For pretty much all of his writings, but particularly Benito Cereno, we're not really sure why or what it was that drew him to the memoir. We don't have the copy that he read. We don't have an annotated version of Amasa Delano's memoir with Melville's underlinings like we do about a lot of other texts. But I don't think it's that hard to understand what it was that drew him to the event. In the historical Delano's retelling of it, it has the triangular symmetry of a play and the psychological and historical depth of a Greek epic, a Greek drama. Homer's Odyssey is not about slavery, but it does tell of a character, Odysseus, who many scholars think represents the first modern man. By that they mean that he had the ability to use his inner thoughts and his inner life and his cunning to manipulate reality, to kind of create a schism between appearance and content, between surf,
between surface and substance. I am nobody, Odysseus says, playing with the subtleties of language in order to gull the Cyclops. And that, in many ways, is exactly what Babo, in Melville's retelling of the story, does, and the rest of the slave rebel troop try to do to escape Delano. They act as if they're inconsequential slaves. Nobody's hardly worth noticing. Now, aside from its sheer audacity, what is most fascinating about the ruse is how it exposes a larger falsehood, a larger deception, on which the whole ideological edifice of slavery rested. The idea that slaves were loyal and simple-minded, people who had no independent lives or thoughts, no inner lives. And if they did have an interior self, that too was within the jurisdiction of their master. That too was property. What you saw on the outside was no different from what there was on the inside. The West Africans used talents their masters said they didn't have, cunning, reason, guile, discipline, to give lie to the stereotypes of what they were said to be, loyal, simple-minded, and faithful. And they did so under extreme circumstances. I'm talking about the real historical West Africans now. They were exhausted and they were dying. Over the course of nearly 2 years from when they were first taken out of their homes in West Africa, many of them were Muslim. They had tracked their journey across half the world from West Africa into the Pacific by following the Islamic lunar calendar. They were brought first into Montevideo, in Buenos Aires, that great sea gulf that is in southern South America. They got caught up in the wheels of corruption and contraband, and they were transformed into commodities. Then they were marched, most histories and most stories and what we know about slavery, we think of the Middle Passage and we think the terrors of the journey are ending more or less when they reach the shores of the Americas. In this case, they continued onward. They were marched across the Pampas, the impossibly flat Pampas, across the whole of the American continent, then up over the Andes, the tallest point of the Andes, under the shadow of the highest mountain in the Americas, and then down into the Pacific. And they were put back on another ship, Benito Cedeño's trial. That was the name of the trial. Macedelano's ship was called the Perseverance. Benito Cedeño's ship was called the Trial, on their way to Lima to be sold in the market. And then they rose up. They rose up on the holiest day of Ramadan, the night of power, the day that the angel Gabriel began to reveal the verses of the Quran to Muhammad. They slaughtered most of the Spaniards, including their slaver, and they demanded to be returned to Senegal, to West Africa. But then, after nearly 2 months sailing in the Pacific, up and down with water and food running out, the rush of power that came from their uprising had fallen away into desperation. Two women died of dehydration. Two children also died of dehydration by the time Delano boarded the ship. So it must have required enormous self-control to resist the temptation to either fight or surrender, to do anything they needed to get water and food. But they did. They managed to summon up this incredible inner resources and reserve in order to shed the trappings of freedom, which in any case had proven elusive with every day they were adrift in the South Pacific, and assume the roles of slaves. And in doing so, in some ways, they embraced a deeper meaning of freedom, the ability to kind of control their inner appetites and their inner passions and to manipulate reality and to perform this remarkable pantomime. It was only late in the afternoon, at around 4 o'clock, that the slave who was playing the role of loyal servant to Benito Cedeño, in real life his name was Mori. Babo was Mori's father, and they were the organizers of this deception and the previous revolt, felt a flush of pride for having gulled the Cyclops, for having gulled the Cyclops for over 9 hours. When Delano climbed off of his boat, still unsure what exactly was going on between the slaves and Benito Cedeño and why Benito Cedeño was treating him with such distance and such coldness, he climbs down the rope ladder into his boat. His men are just pushing off of the hull to row back to the Perseverance. Maury, feeling the kind of rush of pride of having pulled this off, says to Benito Sereno, how many men are on board his ship? And when he's told, he said, well, it'll only take us a few hours to seize the ship and take its provisions, and then you'll be captain of not just this ship, but also his ship. At that moment, Benito Sereno realizes that there's not going to be any end to his ordeal, and it snaps him out of his stupor, and he pitches himself over the side of the ship, and he lands at the bottom, at the feet of the Masa Delano, in his boat. And it's at that moment that Delano, after a bit of confusion and interpretation, realizes just the depth of his deception. Melville does a great kind of rendition of that moment, having the scales fall from his eyes. He sees the Negroes for what they really are. And then Delano, realizing the depths of his deception, begins to mobilize his men to put down the rebellion and take back the ship and re-enslave the West African rebel actors with a particular horrific violence. So the theme of this lecture that I'm honored to be part of is In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom, this lecture series. And I think there's no more powerful exposition of freedom than the German philosopher Hegel's famous master-slave allegory from the early 1800s. The German philosopher begins his description of the master-slave relation with the master believing that he is a sovereign consciousness, independent, existing prior and independent and superior to the slave in his possession, even as he grows materially and psychically dependent on his slave. Soon the solipsism of the master gives way to an acute, to an intense awareness of the slave's being, so much so that he can't imagine a world without him. He comes to realize his utter dependence on the slave, not just on his labor, but on the slave's recognition of his existence. And in turn, as the slave becomes aware of this interdependence, of this dependence, the slave begins to realize his or her equality, as it would be. Hegel's allegory has been called an existential impasse, but it's not really an impasse, since there is an exit. It's not a Beckett play. The whole point of Hegel's parable is to identify how human consciousness evolves to a next level, how it moves towards a higher register of freedom, how it pursues freedom. And it's out of the struggle between the master and the slave that a new world consciousness emerges. Hegel says elsewhere, it wasn't so much from slavery as through slavery that humanity was emancipated. And that's what's so fascinating about this historical encounter on the Pacific, which, by the way, is taking place almost at the same time as Hegel is composing the master-slave dialectic back in Germany. So you have, on the one hand, you have Hegel writing in Germany. On the other hand, you're seeing this performance of the master-slave dialectic by this group of West Africans, as about as far away from Germany as you can imagine in the South Pacific. What's so fascinating about it, though, except it's not a duo, what's going on the trial. It's not a master and slave. There's a third person involved. There's a witness to the dialectic. But the witness, Amasa Delano, is too dense to understand what he's witnessing. And one wonders what exactly, in Melville's hand, how Amasa Delano becomes proxy for the United States. What did it mean that not so much that the United States was embroiled in slavery, but it couldn't even see the terms of its own embeddedness. So in the research that I did, two narrative arcs come out, and that basically is the structure of the book. One traces the West Africans, the story of the West Africans, across the Atlantic and into Montevideo and into Buenos Aires and across the Americas and into the Pacific. The other one follows Amasa Delano on his journeys, and what brings him into the Pacific. And what brings him into the Pacific, which I'll talk a little bit later, is sealing. And their encounter and their clash and the crashing together of these two narratives is the point where a kind of ecological violence associated with resource extraction crashes into the race terror associated with slavery. And it gives us a way of seeing how those two things are interrelated. It uses that event to explore what the great historian of slavery, Edmund Morgan, in the 1970s called the paradox of freedom and slavery in the Americas, the ways in which freedom was dependent on and defined by slavery in all sorts of ways. When Morgan was looking specifically at colonial Virginia, this story that I try to tell looks at the paradox in all of the Americas, north and in south, the Atlantic to the Pacific. So when we think of slavery in America, we usually tend to think of the explosion of slavery that happened after the War of 1812 with the British, after the push into the West, the opening up of the Mississippi, the Louisiana Purchase, the move into Texas, and the cotton lands of the Mississippi, as recently enacted in the very vivid movie 12 Years a Slave, that terrorist system that emerges in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, up to when Melville writes Benito Soriano. But what was happening in the United States was really the last stage of a much more diffused and dispersed explosion. It began in the Caribbean in the 1770s, moved down to Brazil, then Spanish South America, and only reaching the United States until much later. It was starting around the 1770s. Slavery obviously existed throughout all of the Americas since the Spaniards arrived in the and brought the first slaves and first slave ship in the early 1500s. But for centuries, it was a tightly controlled economy. The Spaniards regulated it through a system that they called mercantilism. They limited the number of ports. Only Cartagena and Havana and a few other Spanish ports were allowed to bring in a quota, a limited number of slaves. Only a few monopoly companies or corporations had the right to import slaves. Only a few select, very well-connected merchants had the right to preside over the slave trade domestically. But beginning in the 1770s, Spain begins to unravel. I mean, to use terms that we would associate with today, they deregulated, they privatized the slave trade. And they were very clear about what they were doing. They were instituting what they called free trade in blacks. And Spanish American merchants were demanding more liberty, and what they meant by that was more liberty to be able to buy and sell Africans, to be able to sail to Africa, buy slaves, and bring them back into the Americas. And almost there's almost a kind of tick-tock between every burst of revolutionary ardor during the Age of Liberty, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, the execution of Louis and Marie Antoinette in France. Every one of these kind of revolutionary moments, Haiti declaring independence, was almost followed almost within months of Spain further deregulating the slave trade, lowering taxes, lowering tariffs, allowing individuals to sail to Africa to use their own ships, opening up ports like Montevideo and Buenos Aires, in which slaves, only a few limited number of slaves were allowed to be brought in. It really was a free-for-all. More slaves came into Montevideo in 1803. And again, 1803 is a moment where slavery in the United States is largely thought to be on its way out, and certainly in the North, and a lot of people even thought in the South. More slaves came into Montevideo in 1803 than any year previously. It was a free-for-all. Slaves were involved in almost every aspect of what historians call the market revolution, the capitalist revolution of the Atlantic world, which basically created the modern world, the modern institutions, the laws, the economics that we live with. Enslaved Africans and African Americans slaughtered cattle, they sheared wool, they spun cotton, they wove cloth in workshops in Mexico City, they planted coffee, they boiled Peruvian sugar to make candy. In Ecuador, they made the ships, which were used to bring in more slaves. They were laborers, bakers, brickmakers, liverymen, cobblers, carpenters, tanners, smiths, blacksmiths, rag pickers, cooks, and servants. And it wasn't just the labor that spurred the commercialization of society. The driving of more slaves inland, just like these slaves were in 1803, and across the continent, opened up new routes and expanded old ones. It tied hinterland markets and created new circuits of finance and trade. Historians debate about the role his slave labor played in the making of capitalism, but slaves were much more than labor. They were the flywheel of the market revolution. They were obviously labor. They were investments. They were purchased and rented out. They were credit used to secure loans. They were property. They were commodities. They were capital. They literally made money. Slaves in the mints of Lima trampled quicksilver mercury into silver in order to amalgamate the silver, pressing the toxic poison of mercury into their bloodstream. making the coins, which began to monetarize society. But they also were money. In a lot of places that were cast short, they slaves were the standard on which other goods were valued. But slavery wasn't just an economic institution. It was an emotional and psychic one as well. And there was a deep emotional investment in slavery. For a declining aristocracy, slaves who were kind of losing their footing in this new commercial world in which all that was solid was melting, all that was sure was shaking and crumbling. Aristocrats tended to look at slaves as the last concrete things, along with livestock and land, and they held on tight. For a rising gentry that was doing well in this new expanding market, slaves become status symbols. Gentry women in Buenos Aires, merchant women in Buenos Aires wouldn't go to church, wouldn't go to mass without trailing a long parade of very well-dressed slave women and children behind them. In the U.S., the importance of slaves went well beyond the wealth generated from the cotton they picked in Mississippi or the cane they cut in Louisiana. The paradox of freedom and slavery was political and economic, but as I mentioned, it was also emotional. Capitalism, in many ways, was a massive project of ego formation, creating the modern self, notions of self-interest, inherent rights, notions of personal preference. And baked into that was slavery. Slavery made that possible in all sorts of ways, which we could talk about during the discussion. The way that this particular group of West Africans arrived in the Americas, in Montevideo and Rio de la Plata, they were literally brought into this orgy of corruption. Even though Spain had lowered tariffs and lowered taxes, merchants didn't want to pay any tariffs, any taxes, bringing in their slaves. Probably about half of the slaves brought into Montevideo weren't registered. They were brought in as contraband. This particular lot, or at least some of them, were actually bound for the Caribbean. They were on a Liverpool slaver, and they were intercepted by a French revolutionary pirate named Capitan Morday, who brought them into Montevideo. You know, pirates are often figured as proto-anarchists, sailing the ever-free sea, you know, in thrall to no man. But in this particular case, at least in Buenos Aires and Montevideo, they were vanguard capitalists, merchant capitalists. They would seize British goods, bring it into Montevideo, and by far the most valuable good was slaves. Morday brought thousands and thousands of slaves, and he was a partisan of the French Revolution. He believed in freedom, equality, and liberty. But at the same time, it catches something about the contradictions of the age of liberty that his involvement with the slave trade. You know, today, and as to Amasa Delano, as to the kind of narrative that I tell and the tracing Amasa Delano, Amasa Delano was in the Pacific as a sealer. He was sealing. I don't know what attracted Herman Melville to the Delano story. I speculated about the event itself, but the whole memoir is quite fascinating. Delano was, in his own words, in his own description, somebody who was created by the optimism of the American Revolution. He was born in Duxbury, Massachusetts, a town that was a hotbed of natural law liberalism and republicanism. Duxbury shed early on the kind of Calvinist gloom of predestination and embraced the idea, the proto-Unitarian idea that human nature was perfectible, that men can govern themselves, that they can use their virtues and their disciplines in order to tame their vices and appetites in order to govern themselves and govern their own society. That was the radicalism of republicanism in the 18th century. But if you read Delano's memoir, which he kind of wrote not only to get out of debt, because he was deeply in debt, which I'll talk about a little bit later, but because he believed it was adding to the great storehouse of knowledge. But if you actually read the memoir, it seems like less an encyclopedia of world knowledge than a series of fiascos and deceptions and botches and failures that point to the impossibility of knowledge or the impossibility of doing anything once that knowledge is acquired. His involvement in the trial episode is just one of the many episodes that reveal this, and I think that must have also caught Melville's eye. One thing that he was successful at, though, was sealing, at least for a very short time. Today, as we know, extractive capitalism has spread over our post-industrialized world with a predatory force that would shock even Karl Marx. From the mineral-rich Congo to the open pit mines of Guatemala, from Chile's until recently pristine Patagonia to the fracking fields of Pennsylvania, there's no crevice where some useful rock or liquid or gas can hide, no jungle forbidden enough to keep out the chainsaws or the oil rigs or the elephant killers, and no citadel-like glacier, no hard-baked shale that can't be cracked open, and no ocean that can't be poisoned. And Amasa, in a way, was there at the beginning. A ceiling represented one of the young American Republic's first experiences with boom-and-bust resource extraction beyond its borders. And a good way to think about ceiling is actually to contrast it with whaling and the way Melville talked about whaling in Moby Dick. Melville portrays whaling in that novel as the American industry. It's brutal and it's bloody, but it was also humanizing. Work on a whale ship required intense coordination and camaraderie among the crew. Out of the gruesomeness of the hunt, the peeling of the whale skin from its carcass, and the hellish boil of the blubber, something sublime, at least as Melville figured it, emerged, human solidarity and dignity among men of all races. Sealing was something else entirely. It called to mind not industrial solidarity, but settler colonialism, the isolation and violence of conquest and warfare. Sealers seized territory, fought one another to keep it, and pulled out what wealth they could as quickly as they could to leave their claims abandoned and empty and wasted. The process pitted desperate sailors against equally desperate captains in an as all-or-nothing system of labor relations as one could imagine. So with increasing frequency around the early 1790s, ships left New England, New London, Stonington, Boston, and headed towards that great archipelago of islands in the Atlantic off Argentina and in the Pacific off of Chile. They were on the hunt for a certain kind of fur seal that has a velvety down coat underneath a layer of coarse hair. And it was just in the early 1790s that artisans figured out a technique for extracting the down from the coarseness, from the coarse fur, intact. And a market, a very vibrant seal skin market, developed in Canton in China. Seals were killed by the millions and with a shocking casualness. And again, you know, a contrast with whalings, the danger and of the open sea hunt for a whale created respect among its pursuers for the prey. But the exact opposite happened with seals. They were just clubbed by the millions. Mountains of skinned and reeking carcasses piled up and sands on these islands and the beaches ran with torrents of blood. The killing was unceasing and continuing on to the light. Bonfires were created by the skin carcasses of the seals were used to fire the bonfires, and at times penguins and other sea animals were birds and animals were used as wicks to keep the and kindling to keep the fire going. And this massive kill-off took place not for something primal and needed by everybody, like light and fire that whale oil provided, but it was used for this new demand of a market economy. It was seal fur was harvested to warm the wealthy and meet a demand created by this new phase of capitalism, conspicuous consumption. Pelts were used for ladies' capes and coats and muffs and mittens, gentlemen's waistcoats. Elephant seals on these islands would be taken for their oil in even more horrific manner when they opened their, when they stood up and opened their mouths to bellow, their blubber would quiver. It was kind of an index of their market worth. Hunters would toss rocks into their mouth and immobilize them and then stab them with these long lances. And seal elephants have very high circulatory systems when they're out of water, and they would just gush from these multiple piercings, almost like St. Sebastian. At first, the frenetic pace of killing didn't matter. There were so many seals, rookery after rookery on island after island. There were millions of seals. And Amasa was there for the boom. His very first skinning expedition was in the 1790s, and he was also there for the bust. His second one, after he did well on the first one, he built a second ship to accompany the Pilgrim, which was to accompany his ship on the Perseverance, and his brother Samuel was put in charge. And they headed out in 1803, and this was the voyage where it would encounter their trial. And by this point, the rookeries were disappearing. Within just a few years, sealers had taken so many seals out off of these islands and brought them to China that they couldn't fit in Canton's warehouses. The market was saturated. Prices were plummeting. The seals were left to rot in the rain on the dock. They began to pile up in mountains. And as the prices began to fall, the only thing that the sealers could do was to accelerate the killing to make up the margin until there was nothing left to kill. And it was this way that oversupply and extinction went hand in hand. And in the process, cooperation that existed among sealers during the flush years, during the early years in the 1790s, had given way to bloody battle over pitched battles over islands, over territory, over thinning rookeries. And as money dried up, so did the authority that captains had over their labor. Delano's second voyage, when he left out, which I just mentioned, which he started out in 1803, first headed for Tasmania, for Australia, because he heard seals were thick there, but there were none left. His men deserted because there was no money to make. He wound up having to take on a crew of escaped convicts from a British penal colony in Tasmania. He got into these pitched battles with other sealers on islands in Bass Straits, which separates Tasmania from the Australia mainland, from the Big Island. He eventually gave up and started heading back to Chile to see if there was any seals then. His men began to grouse. They began to conspire. Delano began to have to use more and more physical punishment in order to maintain his authority. So it's at this point that a comparison between the historical Captain Delano and the fictional Captain Ahab actually might clarify things and illuminate just what I think is important about Amasa Delano. Over the years, Ahab has come to represent unhinged American power. There's this great scene in Oliver Stone's Platoon where the sergeant, the homicidal, genocidal sergeant, after slaughtering a village of innocent Vietnamese, one of his underlings said, "He's our Ahab." More recently, Edward Said called George Bush Ahab, or his insane and crazed and obsessive hunt for Saddam Hussein and neoconservative foreign policy equated to the arrogance and hubris that is embodied in that novel. And then Ahab also has also through the 20th century, particularly during the Cold War, come to symbolize a kind of totalitarian power in which he's able to pull his men into his emotional orbit through magnetism, through charisma, and getting them to join in this crazed hunt that will bring him and his men and all around him to disaster. And he came to symbolize a Hitler or a Stalin that's able to use the seductions of ideology in order to sway the masses. But Ahab, in many ways, isn't. Ahab is a rebel. He's actually not a good indicator of power. He violates, all of his action violates economic rationality. There's a great scene in Moby Dick where Starbuck, his mate, says, you know, this pursuit of Moby Dick, this pursuit of the white whale, is going to harm the economic interests of the Pequod's owners. And then Ahab's response is, owners, what cares Ahab about owners, about the owners? Let them stand on the Nantucket beach and howl into the typhoon. I really don't care. I don't know if he said, I really don't care. I added that, but I really don't give whatever. And, it's not rebels like Ahab or totalitarians like Ahab that are world destroyers, that are either at the time or now bringing the world to the blink. It's more people like Amasa Delano who follows the rules, right, who's on the front line of resource extraction. If Ahab is an exception, Amasa Delano is the rule. His authority is rooted not in charisma or emotional bonds, but a more modern and common form of power, the control of labor, hierarchical labor relations, and the conversion of diminishing natural resources into marketable items. And as seals disappeared, so did his authority. Until that is, he came across the Spanish slaver. Delano might have been personally opposed to slavery, yet once he realized he had been played for a fool, he organized his men to retake the slave ship and violently pacify the rebels. And in extremely gruesome ways, the men used the sealing lances that they, or the skinning lances that they used to skin seals to disembowel some of the more recalcitrant rebels. So caught in the pincers of supply and demand and trapped in this vortex of ecological destruction with no seals left to kill and no money to be made and his own crew on the brink of mutiny, Delano rallies his men in pursuit, not in pursuit of a metaphysical white whale, but actually existing black rebels. And in the process, he reestablishes his fraying authority. Now, I'd just like to end with a discussion about what exactly is the empire of necessity and what is the pursuit of freedom. Melville used the phrase empire of necessity in an epigraph that he had for a short story that he published around the time of Benito Sereno. It's this wonderful phrase, seeking to conquer a larger liberty, man but extends the empire of necessity. Now, Melville scholars tend to think that he wrote that phrase himself, even though he attributed it to it's an epigraph, and he attributes to it an unpublished manuscript in the author's possession. I think it was a way of saying what he wanted to say and then citing some unnamed authority. But whatever the case, Melville believed in universal freedom, but he refused an idea of freedom that defined itself as the opposite of slavery. As he grew older, he increasingly criticized what he described as a vile liberty that had taken hold in America. And he came up with this description on the centenary of the American Revolution in 1876, a vile liberty with reverence for naught, not for God, not for nature, not for others. And I think that this is what he was getting at with the phrase empire of necessity and with the larger saying, seeking to conquer a larger liberty. Man but extends the empire of necessity. The idea conveys forward motion. It hints that that it's not the paradox of freedom and slavery that's the problem, but rather the denial of the paradox, the inability to see the paradox, like Amasa on board the trial, watching the Spaniard and the West African and not being able to see what was what. That the problem was America's ceaseless bids to escape the paradox, to believe that it was truly free, not just not a slave, but free of the master-slave relationship that Hegel identifies as key for evolution, for the evolution of consciousness. The problem is America's ceaseless attempts to slip out of the shackles of history, which only serve to deepen old entanglements and create new necessities. The way, for example, the opening of the West didn't solve the problem of slavery, but actually deepened it. Or the way the rise of free trade promised and still promises that if men were set free to pursue their self-interest, an ever more harmonious world would result. And experience has proven otherwise. I mean, in the United States today, a purer, or perhaps a better word is perverse, ideal of freedom has come to hold sway, at least among some. It's based not just on the fantasy of free trade and small government, but also on a more primal animus, an individual supremacy that not only denies the necessities that bind people together, but resents any reminders of those necessities. Herman Melville spent nearly his whole writing career considering the problem of freedom and slavery, but he often did so elliptically, intent seemingly on disentangling the particularities of disentangling the experience of bondage from the particularities of skin color, economics, or geography. He rarely wrote about slavery as an actual existing historical institution with victims and victimizers, but rather as an existential or philosophical condition common to all. Benito Sereno is one exception, and a particularly powerful exception. But even here, Melville, by forcing the reader to adopt the perspective of Amasa Delano, is concerned less with exposing specific social horrors than with revealing slavery's foundational deception. Not just the fantasy that some men were natural slaves, but that others could be absolutely free. There's a sense reading the story that Melville knew, or at least he feared, that the fantasy wouldn't end. That after abolition, if abolition ever came, it would adapt itself to new circumstances, becoming even more elusive and even more entrenched in human affairs. And I think that this is awareness and this dread is what makes Benito Sereno such an enduring story. There's also a sense that Melville identified in Amasa Delano the emergence of a new kind of racism, based not on religious or philosophical doctrine, but on the psychic need to define one's absolute freedom in opposition to another's absolute slavishness. This was a racism that was born in chattel slavery, but it didn't die in chattel slavery. Instead, it evolved in today's cult of individual supremacy, which, try as it might, can't shake off its white supremacist roots. In his memoir, the historical Amasa Delano uses a great term, now obsolete, called a horse market. And he uses it to describe the explosive pile-up, a convergence of currents, three or four currents crashing into each other that's strong enough to scuttle vessels. It's a good metaphor, and that's what the people on board the trial were caught in, a horse market of crashing historical currents, free trade, empire, slavery, and ecological exhaustion, destruction. I think it's also a good metaphor for ourselves, still caught in many of those currents. The different routes that led all involved into the drama in the Pacific reveal the fullness of the paradox of freedom and slavery in America, so perversive it could trap not just slaves and slavers, but men who thought they were neither. Thank you very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.